You're listening to Brand Enabled, the human stories behind branding. This is the place to gain greater insight into the human side of branding. Join Gabriel Cohen as he sits down with branding experts, sharing real-life stories of how they faced complex issues along their journey. Learn how others are dealing with maximizing the power of brand and get valuable advice straight from your peers. Here's your host, Gabriel Cohen.
Really excited to have Justin Steinman on today. Justin's got such an interesting background experience over probably over more than 20 years. And we're going to be going through some really interesting, I think, stories around from that career that relate to brand, starting from the early days at Novell and a fascinating story around how a superior product can actually be beaten by a superior brand. So sometimes having the best product doesn't guarantee success. And then through to his experience at GE, where he was responsible for repositioning and some great lessons that were learned there, especially when it comes to socialization and learnings from leadership that then he was able to apply in going through a rebrand at Definitive Healthcare. So welcome, Justin. Great to have you on. Looking forward to the conversation.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
And where do we find you today?
We find me in lovely Framingham, Massachusetts, in the podcast studio for our own podcast, Definitively Speaking.
Wonderful. And maybe just do as a quick introduction, tell us just a little bit about your trajectory and career getting to where you are today.
Certainly. So I'm currently the Chief Marketing Officer at Definitive Healthcare. I've been here nearly 3 years. I joined here in the height of the pandemic in October of 2020 with the idea of getting the company ready for an IPO, which we actually successfully had on September 15th, 2021. We can talk a little bit about that later. Previous to that, I spent 4 years at Aetna/CVS. I say Aetna/CVS because my first 2 years were Aetna, and then CVS bought us. During that time, I ran product management for Aetna's commercial business, so basically designing all the insurance plans and wellness products that Aetna sold to employers, everything from two employees up to like the Home Depot and everything in between. And then after CVS bought us, I spent my last 2 years there building products that took the combined value of Aetna and CVS and brought to market, which is kind of cool. No cost to the member, minute clinic type stuff, a COVID rapid testing product, virtual primary care, really cool stuff. Previous to that, I spent about 6+ years at GE Healthcare Digital, where I was a chief marketing officer. And we can talk a little bit about the rebrand of my career after business school at Novell, first in a sales engineer role. And then I moved into product marketing. And we can talk a little bit about my time at Novell and our relationship vis-a-vis Microsoft, which was both a competitor and a partner, and is quite a unique story.
So let's go back even before that, because you started your career at Accenture. So you started in consulting. Was there anything that, as you think back through your trajectory, that starting in consulting, what were some of those aspects that you were able to carry forward into your sort of career client side as you grew?
Absolutely. So I graduated under college, went to Dartmouth College with a double degree in English and history. And I thought I was going to be a journalist. I was the editor-in-chief of the Daily Dartmouth. And all the way up until August of my senior year, I was all preparing for a career in journalism. And then I kind of woke up like literally like end of August before I'm going back to my senior year and said, I don't think I want to be a journalist because the world is all about journalism. At that point, it was all about building people up to rip them down. And fundamentally, I'm a construction guy. I like to build things. So I went through corporate recruiting because my father basically just said, I spent $100,000+ for you to go to college. You damn well better get a job, pardon my French. And so I went through corporate recruiting, really not knowing what the heck it was, and was fortunate enough to get a job with Accenture, then Anderson Consulting, as an SAP consultant. True story, the only thing I knew about SAP was those three letters of the alphabet. And so I went with my English degree and went and wrote literally data conversion programs for 4 years to pull data out of old legacy systems and move it into SAP, which is a great learning experience. It taught me a couple of things. It taught me, number one, how to live in a client environment and how to be a business professional. It taught me the value of listening to your client and understanding what their needs are and translating them. And third, it gave me a great global perspective because the job sent me all around the world, Japan, Singapore, Australia, Europe, Indiana. So I really got a good perspective globally on that. It was a great experience working there for about 4 years.
Especially Indiana. I think what's interesting is that if you'd gone down that journalism trajectory, you probably would have then come back into marketing anyway, because that's what so many journalists have done over the last decade.
probably true. I love to write. I've always loved to write. One of the joys of my job today is I still do a ton of writing.
So let's jump into the Novell story, because I think there's a lot of people who will be listening probably who have never heard of Novell. But I remember back in the day, Novell, they were the sort of the bright, shiny star. Like, we talk about how much media and attention tech gets. But for those that don't even know what Novell was, talk about what Novell was and the sort of the leading position they had and how you ended up getting a role there.
Yeah. So Novell is one of the great, interesting stories of technology. So Novell pretty much invented workplace computing. So they had email group-wise before anybody had it. They had a product called NetWare, which was really inter-office networking. They had the WordPerfect Office Suite. If these things all sort of sound like things Microsoft had, it's because they did. And Novell had fantastic engineering. And I mean, NetWare still is running around the world 20 plus, 30 plus years later, but nobody knew about it because Novell really did not excel in marketing. And Microsoft had the idea of building both better brand, easier to understand brand, and probably most important, the leverage of partnerships. And so if you look at it, where Novell lost, they also lost the operating system war. And so Novell lost because they got out-marketed. And so, I mean, think about, they always just joke about the blue screen of death for those people listening of a certain age. Imagine if your car worked like the blue screen of death, where it just suddenly stopped working and you had to reboot it in the middle of the highway. That's what the blue screen of death was, just went blue and you had to restart. And for some reason, Novell was never able to take advantage of that. So I joined Novell in 2004 out of business school. I had done my summer internship there because the chief operating officer of Novell at the time had been the CEO of the startup I worked at before business school. So lesson here, it's all about who you know, right? Networking and who you work for and where they go. And so I joined Novell at the same time as they got into the Linux business. But kind of in classic Novell form, they didn't buy the market leader in Linux. That would be Red Hat. They bought the number two company, SUSE. So all of a sudden, you've had Novell, which is the number two company in all the office suites, losing to Microsoft. We had the number two brand, Linux. And so when I took over product marketing, I decided to reposition the SUSE Linux brand very overtly as a challenger brand, right? And what I told people was, either you're an attacker or you're a defender. And I got to give a shout out to one of my business school professors, Howard Anderson, who taught me that kind of attacker and defender. And the idea was, if you're a Microsoft, you're a market leader. You have almost nothing to gain and everything to lose. Versus if you're an attacker, you have everything to gain and really nothing to lose. At this point, I also should point out that I had an offer to join Microsoft after business school. I would have been the assistant product manager for Exchange in the small and medium-sized business market. Very, very niche. Everything to lose, nothing really to gain. Whereas at Novell, I was the marketing leader, marketing strategist for SUSE Linux, like the whole freaking distro part, in my French. And so we made a decision to, again, position it as a challenger brand. And we had this great, great advertising campaign called Your Linux is Ready. And we positioned it as, hey, we want to work with you as a community, and we're going to package up your Linux and make it better. Whereas Red Hat's this big corporate monster, kind of the Microsoft of Linux, if you will. And that worked really, really well in terms of it. Now, ironically, halfway through my time there, we actually wound up doing a partnership with Microsoft in the old only Nixon can go to China type thing. I won't get into all the vagaries of all the legal stuff, but let's just say that Novell had some patents that Microsoft wanted to kind of clear up. And Microsoft realized they needed to get into Linux because Linux was going into their data center. So in one of the most surreal moments of my life, I found myself briefing Steve Ballmer, the CEO of Microsoft, how to talk about Linux in front of an open source crowd in San Francisco, which is things, you know, you never thought you'd actually do with your life. I mean, this was back in like 2007, 2008, when, remember, Steve Ballmer was like, Linux is the enemy, blah, blah, blah. And so we took Novell on this journey where we repositioned it as a challenger brand to where Microsoft, the enemy, became our partner. And then the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And we wound up competing against Red Hat together, which is quite a crazy experience.
What did Novell essentially do wrong overall that prevented them from being a Microsoft, from being in this sort of leadership position overall as a brand?
It's a great business school case study, and I don't think you could point out one thing. I think it was really the death of a thousand cuts. I think Novell never went bigger and broad enough in their marketing strategy. I think Novell really got hurt by not having a desktop operating system. I think Novell got hurt by not really building the hardware partnerships that Microsoft realized the value of IBM, Dell, and HP could make them into a winner. Whereas Novell, I think, made a decision to go at it by itself. And at some point, sales and marketing beat product quality, right? Novell did not have the blue screen of death. GroupWise worked better, better uptime, more features, but it lacked all the different sales, marketing, and channel that Microsoft so effectively built. And I think that was ultimately the downfall of Novell. We ultimately sold Novell in 2010 to a private equity firm, which then rolled it into MicroStrategy, long story short. There are aspects of Novell software still running around the world, but Novell as a company is no more, sadly.
And then, so after that, you spent the bulk of your career at GE. Talk about that transition and how that all came up.
Yeah, so it was interesting. As I said, I've always prided myself on a builder. I like to build things. And so during the time between when we had a deal signed with private equity to sell Novell and the deal closed, I got a call from a headhunter. Now we're back in like 2010, 2011 timeframe. And it was for an executive role at GE. And back in those days, when GE came calling with an executive role, you answered the phone, period, full stop. And so the offer was to come and be the VP of marketing and really the chief marketing officer for the EMR, electronic medical records and revenue cycle business that GE had bought from a company called IDX. And the CMO of all of GE Healthcare at that point, I was talking to him and he said, look, he goes, you don't need to know anything about healthcare. We don't know a lot about software. We are swimming in healthcare knowledge. So we'll make you a deal. You come here and teach us about software marketing. We'll teach you everything you need to know about healthcare. And so I did that job for about 2 years, 2.5 years. And then Sean went off to go run GE Healthcare Japan. And I became the chief marketing officer of GE Healthcare Digital, which is about a $2.2, $2.3 billion business that had, again, electronic medical records, revenue cycle management, and also a really cool digital imaging business that supported all of the MRI, CT machines that GE made. It was over $1 billion in revenue, that digital imaging business. And the whole thing was branded centricity. And we can talk about the brand evolution there if you'd like.
Yeah. Yeah. Why don't you just go into that?
Sure. So when I took over the centricity brand, we really didn't have a unified story. GE had gotten into healthcare IT through a series of acquisitions. It had left all of the marketing teams intact. And so we had an EMR business, which had its own positioning and messaging. We had a rev cycle business, which had its own positioning and messaging. We had a cardiology imaging business. We had an MRI imaging business. You're starting to see it. We had a PACS and RIS, radiology information and picture archiving and communication system. And so we are a portfolio of brands, and everyone thought that their message should be the leading message. You can imagine how it showed up when we showed up at the CIO and we'd bring six different sales reps with six different messages. And then we'd put, hey, we're all GE, buy from GE. And the customer like, well, does A work with B? What's the overall value proposition? Particularly when there was a point solution in every single one of these individual markets. And our value proposition was, hey, you don't need to buy a point solution. We can be your one-stop shop. And by the way, we've also got the hardware, which is also really important. And we've got the consulting services and hospital operations. And hey, we're GE Healthcare. But GE Healthcare had enough problems trying to get the CT brand and the MRI brand and the X-ray brand and the IT brand to work together. And I had a mess just inside the IT organization with this different type of stuff. And so our CEO, when I took over as CMO, said, Justin, you got to clean this up. And I said, absolutely. And so we decided, and this is the lesson learned, he and I decided to reposition all the brands around value-based care. Now, value-based care is really around the whole idea of your doctor treats you as a patient and doesn't get paid for service, but rather gets paid for keeping you healthy. kind of where healthcare is going as an overall industry. And in 2014, during this, I was still fairly cutting edge type stuff.
Oh, it's massively cutting edge. There's still a lot of people that you talk to and they'll sort of look at you blankly when you talk about value-based care, but it's, we thought we'd be further along right now, but that's a different show.
That's my podcast, definitively speaking. We talk about that all the time. But at that point, we were talking about value-based care and we were really excited about it. And he and I came up with this whole positioning around how each of our different portfolios are going to do this. And Centricity is going to be make Centricity center, patient at the center. He and I, and notice I keep saying he and I, because there's a punchline coming here, cooked all this up. We were fully aligned. And so he's like, okay, January staff meeting, we're going to get in, we're going to roll this all out, and everybody's going to love this. So I walk into the January staff meeting with all of my peers, the head of sales, the CFO, the heads of the different GMs of the different product lines. And I'm thinking, feeling like I'm the man. I got like shirts pressed, sport coat on, like, this is great. They're going to love it. And they hated it. Every last one of them hated it. We'd only put 30 minutes on the agenda for me to introduce this concept because the CEO and I just thought it was so blindingly obvious. Everyone's going to love this, rubber stamp it, Justin, go to town. And they hated it because they weren't involved. And I had been on this like 6-month journey with the CEO. We'd done market research. We talked to customers. We'd done it in a corner. We hadn't brought everybody with us. And so one of my great mentors at Novell, a guy named John Dragoon, had given me a great piece of advice that somehow I completely forgot in this process, which is, Justin, it's better to get 80% of the way to your destination with 100% of the people on board than 100% of the way to your destination by yourself. At GE, I'd gone 100% of the way to my destination by myself. And so we literally had to blow up the rest of the staff meeting and the entire agenda literally got crumpled up, thrown out the window. And I spent the next 2 days bringing the leadership team on the journey that I had gone on over the 6 months around the brand evolution, the market research, the repositioning, the look and the feel, everything we wanted to do. Ultimately, we got that 80% of where I needed to get to, and I had 100% of the people on board. But when I tell you it was emotionally painful, it was like dragging my fingers across a chalkboard for 2 consecutive days because I had been a really, really bad team player and I had not brought my teammates with me. And that's a lesson I'll keep for the rest of my life.
Well, I imagine there's an aspect to that, which is pretty feels for them, like you've thrown a grenade and now they have to deal with it. And they're going to be impacted by a lot of these changes, whether from salespeople and how they're going to sell. They're probably thinking about how they're going to be compensated. CFO's thinking about, well, how does that change how we measure and report on things?
It's a grenade. And it taught me a really important lesson about marketing. And it's really influenced them. I would tell you that was one of those pivotal moments in my entire career, frankly, because it really changed my whole philosophy of marketing. It taught me so much. And one of the things I realized is that everybody has a stake in marketing, right? And I don't get to tell the CTO whether we should use Amazon Web Services or Google Cloud or Microsoft Azure. I have exactly zero qualification to offer an opinion on that, right? I took 1 computer science class in college. That doesn't qualify me 25 years ago. But when I go and I speak to the market, on behalf of that CTO and all his engineers, I am speaking on his behalf. And he needs to feel like what I'm saying about GE or Definitive Healthcare or whatever company I'm working at in the future, even though I never want to leave DH, you've got to realize that you're speaking on behalf of these people and you've got to include them and make them feel like they're there because they're emotionally invested. It's the same thing with the CFO and everybody in finance. And obviously the sales team needs to be because they've got to carry your message to customers. And if people don't believe, don't feel like they've been heard out in their input, it's like they're going to reject the organ, if you will. And marketing, everybody, we're all marketers. We joke about it in marketing. Everybody's in marketing. We joke about it. But the reality is we're all marketers. Everybody watches TV. Everybody reads the internet. How many ads do you see on a given day? So you've been taught what effective marketing is. We all watch a Super Bowl and say, that ad was great. That ad was terrible. We all have an opinion on that. We all know when people screw up marketing, hello, new Coke. And so as a CMO or any marketing leader, as it is, you've really got to bring people in. You've got to consider, you've got to leave your ego, not even at the door, you got to leave your ego outside the building to get that input. And then the best marketing leaders can synthesize all of that input and all of that emotion from everybody in the company and turn it into something transformational. That was my big lesson there.
Yeah. And it's interesting you talk about one aspect of this, which is everyone has to live with the decisions that marketing makes. Also, because when you come home or you're at a dinner party, you talk about who you work for, people might have a perception of that brand as well. So there's that even bigger emotional resonance. But I think that there's this other aspect that can get in the way as well when you talk about brand, where everyone feels that they have an opinion. Like you said, you're not going to go and question the CTO's decision on what cloud hosting platform to use, but everyone's going to have an opinion on the logo or the identity or the positioning or the words that we're using. So I don't know if there's another role in organization where change management has become a more important aspect of the skill set. If you're a brand leader or if you're a CMO, can you maybe talk a bit about that? Like, could you expand on what you might have learned around how do you become a good change manager and what change management lessons you've learned?
Yeah. And so I can actually tell you a story about how we did it here at Definitive Healthcare. I like to tell my team all the time, you have to hear everybody out. You don't necessarily have to listen to them. Right. And that's a really big lesson. I will hear anybody's opinion and I'll listen to you talk for hours if I have to. And you got to have a lot of patience. But at the end of the day, the board is paying me to be the expert and they've hired me to trust my judgment. And I can synthesize everybody and I can help you understand why we made the choices that we made. But ultimately, after I've heard you out, we're going to go in a certain direction and I'm going to try to get everybody a little piece of where they are so where they can see. But also ultimately, if your idea is powerful enough, it's special enough, everybody will start to feel how it is there. And then there are all sorts of tips and tricks. I'll tell you the story about what we did here at Definitive Healthcare. How to do that. So I joined Definitive Healthcare in October of 2020. And the CEO and the board brought me in with the express instruction that said, hey, we're going to go public in 2023. You got a couple of years. We really never invested in marketing. And I took a look around. They had one product marketing person, never had spent a dime on brand. Our business was healthcare data and analytics to help you grow. That ain't wrong. Not really aspirational, not really exciting, not really a category. It's a kind of what? And I turned to CEO, I said, this is a 2-year construction. He goes, you got plenty of time, relax, Justin. 2 years, I know we're on this path. And so I remember coming to our first board meeting and I present to the board like my diagnosis. All right, we're going to build product marketing from the ground up. We're going to build demand gen. I want to overhaul marketing operations. We're going to start building a brand and I'm going to need to hire a branding agency. Help me think through this strategically. And at the board meeting, some guy comes in, one of our investors says, so we've done all of this analysis and we think the IPO window is going to close around the end of 2021. So you guys are going to go public next summer. And I'm like, what? And they're like, oh yeah, we're going to go public maybe next fall. And I'm like, I got to rebrand the company. He's like, yeah. You can do that while we do an IPO. This just in to anybody listening, do not rebrand a company during an IPO if you want to sleep. It is a ton of work and is a ton of moving parts. The whole year was a blur. We got it done. And I'll tell you some of the story around that in a second. But that was a crazy time to go from reposition the company. When I say we reposition the company, we did vision, mission, tagline, look and feel, logo, product naming hierarchy, you name it, the whole kit and caboodle. And then included in that is a complete and total website overhaul, a complete and total new about us, a new website upgrade to a new technology platform, and all the associated pieces of an IPO, analyst day decks, and the whole kit and caboodle.
In that sort of rebrand process, did you have people inside your team who had gone through something like this before?
So I did. So going all the way back, the funny story here. So I told you about Your Linux is Ready, however many minutes ago it was. So my account manager on the Your Linux Reddit campaign, I'd stayed in touch with throughout the years. And when I came here, she was still working at the same ad agency. I called her up and I'm like, hey, I just joined Definitive Healthcare. We're going to do a massive rebrand and I need a VP of corporate marketing. You want to leave the agency side and come join me. And she had specialized for 20 years in being an ad agency focused on healthcare and technology brands. Seems like a pretty good fit for a healthcare technology SaaS company. So I convinced her to come work here for me. And so she and I did this together. We hired a third-party agency. I'll give a shout out to my friends at Superhuman, a fantastic branding agency. And so what do we do? So Superhuman had this really interesting process, and it was called the archetype process. And they helped us figure out who they are. Now, for those people who aren't listening, who don't know what an archetype is, you can think about an archetype as certain types of personalities that people think about. And you can think of it, it works everything from friends, where Joey is the funny guy, Rachel is the beauty, Monica is the control person, to Star Wars, where Han Solo is the rogue, Luke Skywalker is the hero, Obi-Wan Kenobi is the genius, right? Leia is the emotional leader. So we did a series of archetype research to figure out what archetype we think Novell is. We surveyed all 500 employees. So everybody.
You mean definitive? Sorry, you said Novell. You mean definitive?
Sorry, definitive. Yes. Sorry, excuse me. We surveyed all 500 employees at Definitive Healthcare, explained to them what an archetype was, gave them a little video, showed them actual clips of Star Wars and Friends to make it relatable, and then said, hey, what do you think Novell is? Here's a survey. You're involved at step one of the rebrand process. So as opposed to the world at GE, when the CEO and I had gone into a corner and done all this work, I involved all 500 people at step one. So then we went off and we realized through, as a result of the survey, we also surveyed a bunch of customers, that the value of Definitive Healthcare is that we're a navigator. We can help you navigate the healthcare ecosystem, almost like a Waze for healthcare. And so we said, okay, now that we know our archetype, that we're the navigator, and you can kind of show it to everybody. And we rolled this out. We actually brought the agency in. We did a webinar for everybody because we were remote. Everyone's like doing a webinar from their bedrooms or whatnot. But they saw the research. They understood what the archetype was. And we said, okay, now we're going to go and explore how we can bring a brand to life around navigation. But does everybody agree that we help you navigate the healthcare ecosystem? I was like, yeah, that makes sense. So all of a sudden, everybody emotionally is like on board, right? And so then we went off and we did more research. We came up with a bunch of different look and feels. Now, how do you control some of this? Jan, who is our VP of corporate marketing, is still here. Jan and I know what good creative is. So we saw dozens of treatments for creative and the look and feel and what we want to look at. We picked our three favorite and brought that to the entire executive leadership team. So they had a choice, but it was kind of Jan and Justin's choices. And we had a 1, 2, or 3, but ultimately we could live with 1, 2, or 3. If even our number three, the whole ELT really, really wanted number three, we would have lived with it. So we gave them a choice, but it was a controlled choice of how they felt like it. We came to them with a revised vision and mission. And then we said, okay, how do you feel about this? Does this represent who you are, right? Our vision is to transform data analytics and expertise into healthcare commercial intelligence. We'll come back and talk about healthcare commercial intelligence in a second. Suddenly we said, and you know what? We are transforming. Who here wants to be aspirational? Do you want to deliver healthcare data analytics or do you want to do transforming? Everybody's like, I want to transform. Like, put your leadership position. You give them that. So the big aha that we had, though, was that we needed a category. Nobody does what we do. I like to joke that if a couple of our competitors got together and had a baby, that would be Definitive Healthcare. But we were unique in a category. And we had mapped out this entire healthcare ecosystem, given everybody Definitive ID, which is kind of the equivalent of Dun & Bradstreet number, and mapped the relationships as to how it all fits together so we could help you navigate it. But what does that mean? That's really wordy. So we said, we don't give you healthcare intelligence, right? Because healthcare intelligence is what your doctor has. We do commercial intelligence, which is we started looking at our customers and saw so many of our customers have a chief commercial officer, someone responsible for sales and marketing and maybe product development. And you said, we're healthcare. What if we create this new category of healthcare commercial intelligence and suddenly we're the industry leader in healthcare commercial intelligence? And we start repositioning ourselves as the industry leader in healthcare commercial intelligence. So then I go back to the team and I'm like, who wants to be an industry leader? And I was like, I do. I'm like, all right, Here's our category, healthcare commercial intelligence. Here's why it works. So we can transform data and analytics, thinking all the way back to who the description was, healthcare data and analytics to help you grow. We can transform data analytics and expertise, because hey, we're all experts, into healthcare commercial intelligence so that you, our customer, can accelerate your path to commercial success. So now we've taken it, we've made it all about our customer. Everyone's kind of there. Said, all right, now we got a tagline for you. Discover opportunity. Because by the way, sales is all about opportunity. Navigation, discover opportunity. Everybody likes that. And so we put together this whole package that explained not only the what, but the why, and grounded it in the research. And then we brought not only the ELT on the whole journey, but the whole company on the journey. Took a lot of feedback, listened to a lot of people out. And then we rolled out training. We rolled out stories. We gave everybody a new PowerPoint deck. We celebrated it. And so we repositioned the whole company. But I can tell you without a doubt in my mind that had I not put my foot in my mouth so badly at GE Healthcare Digital on that centricity rollout, I would not have been able to do what we did successfully here at Definitive Healthcare.
So when you do that big heavy lift and you give people the training, what happens next? Because it used to be that you think, great, that's the brand work done. I can go back to other things, demand gen, their marketing. But if you don't sustain it, if you don't keep on top of it, it can revert back, it can atrophy, it can become the Wild West very quickly. What have you done since then to continue to reinforce it and sustain it? And maybe even if you can talk about how you can start to even translate it to how that might start to impact experience, how that might start to impact culture, other things that might not even be under your domain.
Yeah, absolutely. So first off, Jan's still here and she's helping me build the brand and she has a great team working for her. So we think a lot about building the brand and it's a number of things. So first off, from a cultural perspective, I love that you brought it up because I like to joke that marketing is oftentimes a chief cheerleader inside the company, right? If we're not the most positive people inside the company rooting us on, who should be? We also in marketing here at DH were responsible for internal communications as well. So we have the opportunity to constantly reinforce the brand and everything. So of course, something as pedantic as our internal weekly newsletter, our Monday mention is Definitive Branded, right? And what's going on in the world of healthcare commercial intelligence this week? Subtle, but it's there, right? We said we have started together a great PR campaign around, we hired an agency, shout out to my friends at Highwire, and our PR strategy is very much about according to Definitive Healthcare. So we have the largest database of healthcare information. If you want to know how many babies were born in Houston like last month, I can tell you. If you want to know the percent of cancer patients who are inside the Mayo Clinic and where they are going, which doctors are seeing, I can tell you. I have all this, it's all de-identified data, so I can't give you names and identifying stuff, but I can give you pictures of that. Very valuable. So every time someone in the newspaper wants to write, you know, or online, no newspapers anymore, but the online journal, the online Times, the online Washington Post, online Axios, writes about healthcare, we've positioned ourselves as the go-to source. We'll give you the stats you need. How many retail clinics are in the United States, right? All the different types of, but the business of healthcare, which everybody writes about, we've been part of that. Well, according to Definitive Healthcare, the industry leader in healthcare commercial intelligence, there are XXX retail clinics in the United States over and over and over again. We've put together this podcast you've heard me refer to several times. Definitively speaking, we do that as a brand build, a data-driven look at healthcare. Never, ever pitched our product in the podcast. That's sacrosanct. But we bring a lot of cool guests on and talk about what's going on in healthcare. And if you walk away going, wow, Definitive Healthcare taught me something about healthcare and was really data-driven today, that's a huge win for me. I'll take that all day long. We don't have the money for an advertising campaign, so we don't do anything for that. But we do talk a lot about a data-driven culture here at Definitive, and data permeates everything that we do. I could sit here and tell you right now from a marketing perspective how each of our four different sales and marketing channels are doing by each of our six vertical segments, how many MQLs we generate, how many demos, how many opportunities, how many wins, what's our conversion percentage. Look at that data every day. So data-driven and analytics is endemic to who we are as a company. And then we're selling data and analytics, healthcare commercial intelligence to all of our customers. So you can see we are what we eat. Giving people the aspirational idea of being the industry leader in a category is really interesting. Again, everybody wants to be the leader in something. And so you ask yourselves, is this how an industry leader would behave? Now, granted, it's a small category that we're in. We are in healthcare commercial. It's not the most giant market. It's roughly $10-11 billion. Big enough market for us. But when you're a customer service rep on the phone and you know that we're the industry leader in space, have I delivered industry leading customer service to my person, to my customer today? What does that look like? Right? Are we designing the next generation of great analytics that are out there? Are data scientists really generating new intelligence? So we never hear talk about insight, because my least favorite word in marketing is actionable insight. If you have some 5 minutes today, go Google actionable insight, and everybody and their mother is marketing actionable insights, regardless of whatever industry they're in. So we talk about healthcare commercial intelligence, and intelligence is that next level thing that sits at the top of data and analytics and expertise. And so as our data science team, are they generating new form of intelligence? Ironically, we've been talking about intelligence for years before now we're in the boom, this beautiful AI boom. So, you know, we glommed onto that. We launched Atlas AI, Atlas Artificial Intelligence, but we've been doing healthcare data commercial intelligence for years. But that kind of aspirational and intelligence language or customer service, that's how a lot of the brand work kind of infiltrates the company culture every day.
Yeah, it's interesting. You find that the internal comms piece becomes a really important determinant in being able to control some of that and influence that internal message and weave things in a subtle way. It's Absolutely. A really interesting journey and story. So we're sort of just going to jump to what we sort of call the wisdom round. I'm going to throw a few through curveballs at you, but we'll understand some of your perspectives just as a leader. So when you think about leading and managing people, what are sort of some of your core guiding principles?
So it's really great. It's a great question. First off, I like to say that I hire for both aptitude and attitude, right? And so aptitude is, do you have the skills to do the job? That's a very hard, kind of very quantitative, either have or don't. Attitude is, if I tell you I want a box, a square box colored in by Friday, I want you to come to me by Wednesday and be like, no, Justin, what you actually asked for was a triangle and it's already colored in for you. And here's why what you wanted was a triangle. That's attitude, right? So I hire really smart people. I set really big, hairy, audacious goals, and then I get the hell out of their way and I let them do their work. And I ask them to tell me what resources they need. My job is to get resources and remove roadblocks. It's not to do your job. It's not to micromanage you. My job is to trust you, to empower you. One of my great mentors years and years ago, and I've been fortunate to have so many mentors in my career, a guy named Ron Hovsepian, who was actually the CEO of Novell and is now the CEO of a company called Indigo AG. Ron told me, Justin, there are two types of people in this world. This is advice I keep telling everybody. I use this advice to say, there are two types of people in this world. Are you a grant trust person or are you an earn trust person? A grant trust person says, I'm going to empower you to do the right thing until you prove to me that you can't. An earned trust person says, I'm not going to trust you to do the job until you prove to me that you can. I operate every day in a grant trust environment, and I find it freeing and liberating. I have worked for earned trust managers. It's miserable, and I won't mention those people by name, but I really operate in a grant trust. So hire the best people, grant them trust, get them resources, get out of their way.
Yeah, I love that grant trust versus untrust. It's the same, like you're playing offense versus defense. It's just, it really is a mindset principle. I want to touch on your point about attitude. How do you, or through your experience, how do you test for that in the interview process or in those initial conversations? What are your sort of secret tactics or strategies to get to that in a very confined time? Because sometimes you're doing that in an interview. Sure, if you've worked with someone in the past, that's easier because you know that.
So I'm going to give you my secret. And this is a question that I ask every single person who I interview, literally, since I've been hiring people for 20 years and I have not gone through an interview where I haven't asked this question. So if you've listened to this far into the podcast and you're coming in for an interview with me, you can prepare your question. This is your big reward here. The question I ask is, I want you to pick a product that is marketed well from any industry that you want, cannot be an Apple product. And I want you to tell me why. And what that does is it requires you to take a very unstructured question, create a structure, answer it, show me that you understand marketing, create logical answers, justify your reasoning. And I also learn a little bit about you by the product that you pick. And how you answer that question, I can very, very quickly figure out if you got the right attitude.
I'm laughing, and we didn't talk about this before because we have exactly the same question. We just said, what brand do you admire most and why? And you can't say Apple.
Mm-hmm. Right. But to me, it's more than brand. I never just ask about the brand, as I want marketed well, because brand is one component. That's right. I want people to talk about channels. I want people to talk about messaging. I want people to talk about distribution, pricing. You got your 4 P's, your 7 P's, all that type of stuff.
You've referenced your agency partners a bit in this conversation. What makes a good agency partner for you? And through your experience, what advice do you give to others to get the most out of agency partners?
Yeah, so a couple of things. One, I'm very, very careful that I work on the agents I work with. I always work with small agencies because I want to work with the very, very top senior talent. And if I'm at a bigger agency, I'm going to be a smaller customer. I'm not going to get the big talent. So I always work with small agencies. The second thing that I do is I don't let them PowerPoint me. I don't let anybody PowerPoint me. If you come into my office with a PowerPoint, I'm probably going to rip you apart and send you out of my office. And I don't like to rip anybody apart. If you come into my office with a spreadsheet, let's dive in, baby, and let's work on it together. Because if you're PowerPoint, you're pitching me. I don't want to be pitched. I want to discuss. I want to have a give and take. I want you to question me. I don't know everything. If I'm hiring you, it's because I know that you're an expert. So let's have a give and take, and let's try to problem solve together. And in that work, in that initial interview of an agency, I can get a feel for how you problem solve and how we're going to work together. And then I can figure out if we can work together. And I don't want someone who's going to tell me how smart and good looking I am, because I'm neither of those. I want somebody who's going to push me, who's going to give me advice, who's going to say, hey, I did this at this customer over here, and here's why it worked. So the reason I hired, for example, Superhuman for the brand repositioning was one of my best friends from B-School had used them to reposition his company in advance of an IPO. And my friend Matt and I knew Matt, and I knew how well he thought, and I know how similar we thought and where we thought differently. And so he introduced me to the owner of the agency. So she and I sat down and had a conversation from the start. And I knew because she had worked well with Matt where I should push and where I shouldn't push, because I knew him so well. She didn't PowerPoint me. To this day, she's never PowerPointed me. We don't use them anymore because they really are a brand repositioning agency. But I've referred her 4 different pieces of business based on our work here. And that our PR agency, I had actually worked with the founding partner there at GE Healthcare because she worked in the PR department then. She was much earlier on in her career, but I always thought she was really smart and was going to do great things. Guess what? She's really smart and went on to do great things. And so when I hired her, she knew also, I'm not going to PowerPoint Justin. That's the worst thing ever I can do. So she came in and it's like, okay, Justin, I know you. I know what you like. I know what you don't like. And here's my assessment of what DH is doing right. And here's what you guys are doing wrong. And that's what I love an agency coming and telling me what I'm doing wrong. Great. That's why I want to hire you. Fix what I'm doing wrong. I got about 10% of the answers, which means there's another 90% out there for you.
And it sounds like once you then have someone you know you're going to enjoy working with, you sort of pull the trigger. You don't necessarily even need to make it into a competitive process.
I always have a competitive process. I always talk to people. Absolutely. I've always, even for the brand redesign, we actually put an RFP. We spoke to 7 different agencies for that. Our first PR agency that I hired here was another one that didn't work out. So we parted ways mutually. The second time when we hired Highwire, we talked to 3 different agencies. But Highwire far and above, now maybe they leveraged the fact that I had worked with Sage before and she knew how to work with me and my team. That was great. But now Real Sage works with the PR team and I surf in and out because I got a million things I'm doing. And I trust her to be an extension of our team.
Yeah. So I think that's the key thing, right? It's this notion of if you can see your agency as extension of the team on your side of the table and challenge them to behave in that way.
I want them on my side of the table, but I want them to challenge us.
Right.
That's really, really important to me. I don't want them just to be an order taker. If you're an order taker, you're not going to fit with the culture of the marketing team. I've got 35 people here on this team. There's not a single order taker among them. I got 35 independent thinkers, 35 experts. I want them to basically hear the general direction that I want the team to go in. Then they figure out the right way. They come back and tell me, you need to do it this way, Justin, not that way. Love that. That's what I dream about. And that's what I want my agencies to do as well.
So one question that I'm asking everyone at the moment, what are your thoughts on the Twitter rebrand to X? Genius or worst decision ever or something else?
I'm going to go with worst decision ever. Well, maybe not worst decision ever might be a bit of an overstatement.
Sorry, what brand decision?
Yes.
Brand decision.
It's probably one of the worst brand decisions I've ever seen somebody make. First off, X is not distinctive. X is so many different things that are out there. Third, people are still talking about it as Twitter. Twitter has such brand equity built in over years. The little bluebird, everybody was tweeting. Why do you do that? It's a tribute to your ego, essentially. You threw a bunch of brand equity out the window for what I can tell is no good reason. And yeah, I don't like it.
Yeah, I think if you were to give someone $10 billion and say, okay, go and try and build a brand with as much aided, unaided awareness and equity and distinctiveness that Twitter has, I think most marketers would struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we will see over the next few years how this plays out. Justin, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
That's all for today's episode. We hope these insights from top brand leaders help you as you face your own branding roadblocks. Remember that you're not alone in the challenges you face, and there are always impactful, creative, and human ways to solve brand problems. If you would like to further connect with fellow elite brand leaders and join our community, send an email to gcohen@monogle.com. Thank you for joining us. See you on the next one.